On this episode of Deep Dive, we are going to go on an awesome series that will really cover all Japan women's wrestling's history. And we're going to start off right from the top in the 70s. So I hope you're ready to go down memory lane. I'm excited to talk about this. So let's get into it.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Women's Wrestling Talk, the number one women's wrestling show on the planet.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Deep Dive. I am really, really excited to talk about All Japan women's wrestling's history. When I thought about doing Deep Dive, I knew that this was going to be something that I really wanted to get into because of the illustrious history that All Japan women's wrestling has, and because of everything that encompasses All Japan women's wrestling, all of the decades that had many twists and turns. It is impossible to cover all that history in just one episode. So over the next few weeks, possibly spanning March and a bit of April, I will be going over the different decades, not just of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, because as we start getting into the late 80s, 90s, and 2000s, there was a lot going on with different promotions that sprang up at the same time. So for this particular episode, going into the 70s, obviously, it makes sense that we are solely focusing on All Japan's women's wrestling. And over the past 5 years, we've seen a true revolution for women's wrestling, a bustling metropolis in pro wrestling that sees women all over the world reach heights collectively in the industry that we've never really seen on many continents. However, even though this kind of success is new for women in the Western world, Japan is not a stranger to embracing women in wrestling and letting them hit heights that are still hard to reach for a lot of women in wrestling today. Due to so many twists and turns in Joshi wrestling history, we really have to take this history decade by decade, and we are starting with the 70s. The All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling Federation and the All Japan Women's Wrestling Club was started in 1948, which was the first women's wrestling promotion in Japan. By the mid-60s, the association fell apart due to infighting between the member promotions, and female wrestling was relegated to being a sideshow act and striptease theaters. So you did not have that sense of respect for what women's wrestling could possibly be, and they certainly weren't leveled to the same as their male counterparts when we're talking about that post-World War II era of wrestling. And you see some promoters that are possibly trying to change the outlook of women's wrestling, or at least trying to develop it in the country. But in the late 40s and early 50s, this is the uphill battle. So following a tour in November 1954, the Mildred Burke came to Japan to actually have a really successful tour with her promotion, World Women's Wrestling Association. And I feel that in a lot of conversations about the early stages of women's wrestling, or even the history of female promoters in the industry, usually Mildred Burke and the World Women's Wrestling Association is left out or overlooked in this, but she had a lot of success with this company. And it's, to me, even more evident with what she was able to do to bring women's wrestling to both Mexico and Japan and really light the fire under these countries to bring women's wrestling to the masses in a bigger way that had been previously tried. And I think that the success of Mildred Burke was able to find after leaving the NWA World's Women's title behind, and her ex-husband and manager Billie Wolf was astounding. She had a heart for building up women's wrestling globally. And this love that she had really helped to build a relationship with other promoters in Japan and really helped to show or have a blueprint of what women's wrestling could be in Japan. So I think that this was a huge stepping stone to us seeing, or possibly a lot of promising promoters in Japan seeing what women's wrestling could be. So owe a lot to Mildred Burg with her coming and really showing the different styles, the way that you can showcase the women that would obviously be respectful to them and really respectful to women's wrestling. So by 1968, there was another attempt to organize the sport of women's professional wrestling. And that was made with the founding of All Japan Pro Wrestling Association. And this was done by the Matsunaga brothers. At that time, Fabulous Moolah was also, I guess, taking the hint to try to look into the territory of Japan as she came to the area to trade her belt with Yukiko Tomo and to lend some legitimacy to the NWA Women's Championship in Japan. And it seemed like a good idea on paper, especially because of how storied the history was of the women's NWA title and how much not only Mildred Burg, Joan Byers, or other champs did for the title, but what Fabulous Moolah had done with that title thus far. But that particular appearance with Fabulous Moolah didn't really have the same effect as Mildred Burg coming over and really laying a foundation for women's wrestling in Japan. But even with that, All Japan Women's Wrestling had their first official show on June 4th, 1968. And All Japan Women's Wrestling received a TV deal with Fuji TV in that same year. And I think that you really have to highlight how big of a deal this was, because this was a massive opportunity for Joshi Wrestling in its infant stages, essentially. Millions of people in the country could view the programming. Fuji TV saw that there was a strong female demographic that wanted a diverse lineup, and All Japan Women's Wrestling certainly would fit into that category. At the time, due to that almost seedy past of women's wrestling in Japan, Fuji TV had a few demands coming into this deal. One was that they had to have a music routine in the beginning of the show. They had to have striking colors that the women were wearing and all around the arena, and they had to have a welcoming image. To be honest, just the overall wholesome program on every level, and you certainly see that in those early stages of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. Everything is meticulously done to make you feel that this is honestly another sporting event. These early years see a crowd that's a bit more serious and treats it like any other sporting event. In my opinion, especially when you see the jogging suits and the teams surrounding the ring during certain matches, very much gives me Olympic-style wrestling event as far as how they were marketing All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. Probably, I would say, for like the first 5 years, it really gave that those raucous crowds that we started to see didn't really come into the mid to late 70s in All Japan Pro Wrestling. And one thing that I was excited to see as I was doing my research and really wanted to look into those early stages of the company, it was really exciting to see different women, even if there was just one at each event, actually be a part of commentary and the type of respect that they were giving as they were commenting on these matches and interacting in a very professional but fun way with the male commentators was so refreshing to see in the 70s. I loved seeing, even at the beginning, the women, young girls that were ecstatic to be in the front row of these events and cheer on their favorites. It just really gave off that this was meticulously created to give a very young female fan base something that they can really enjoy, that they can feel like they were a part of, even in the early stages. So that was really cool to see. And just a bit of history, or kind of like a timeline of the WWWA World Single Championship title and the tag titles. On October 15th, 1970, in Tokyo, Marie Vegnon lost the WWWA World Single Championship to Akako Kyo. And All Japan Women's Wrestling had a new World Championship singles belt. And then next year, they were able to acquire the WWWA World Tag Team Championships as well. And Jumbo Miyamoto, who I absolutely love, and Akiko Koyo were the first tag team champions in the promotion on June 20th, 1971. And I really think it's impressive to see that respect for Mildred Burke and what she achieved with her promotion and those titles, that the WWWA titles were so heavily respected that All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling kept those titles in the company and considered them to be the higher tier belts. And I love the exchange with Mildred Burke giving those titles to the company after she retired and, you know, set off into the sunset. And All Japan Pro Wrestling using, Women's Pro Wrestling using those belts in the company until they closed their doors in 2005. I just think that is just amazing how, and just like I talked about a bit in the first episode of Deep Dive, with Mildred Burke's history in NWA, that she was able to start such a successful global promotion that did a lot of business in different countries in the world and really establish a very, very loyal, kind, respectful relationship with a lot of different promoters and wrestlers in Japan, to the point that the titles that she created in her promotion were still being used in All Japan's women's wrestling and held by some amazing legends over the decades that that the promotion was alive and kicking. I just absolutely love that. And I'm assuming it must have been an honor for her to see the way those titles continue to have a strong legacy. And with All Japan Women's Wrestling, they followed the traditional trope of booking a Japanese face and a foreign heel. And that really remained the norm for decades to come. And we saw that in other promotions too for decades upon decades, especially in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and companies all over the world. So they wanted to make sure that they were following those norms in their company as well. You had the tag team belts that were traded for a whopping 56 times between 1971 and 1975. These exchanges between the tag teams didn't really have evolved storylines that would follow in the upcoming decade. They were really just an opportunity to showcase the women in the division. And even with that, we would see a tag team boom in the middle of the decade that, in my opinion, still rivals any company's showcasing of women in wrestling, for sure, in my opinion. And we will definitely get into that. This pattern of title swaps for the tag team division did change a bit with the outrageously successful tag team of Beauty Pair. And I will get into that in just a bit, because that's like a whole thing with seeing that type of history that these women had. On March 19th, 1975, Mark Fumiyake won the WWA Championship from Jumbo Miyamoto, which was a big deal due to Jumbo's successful run up until that point. She was a very dominant champion and for a few years really helped to shape what you thought of that world's women's title in All Japan Women's Wrestling. So that was a really big deal. And after Maku won the WWA world's title, we see a flip-flop of the women's world title between Jumbo Miyamoto, Mariko Akagi, Maki Iwata, and Jackie Sato before a legendary heel enters the promotion at a very young age, which is a pattern that we will see in this company. And that legendary, well, soon would be after a few decades, was Monster Ripper, which I will be talking about as well. Since she won the WWWA Championship on July 31st, 1979. And she really brought in an 80s flavor that we would come to see in the promotion and love. And I love how they ended off this amazing decade of laying the foundation of what All Japan Women's Wrestling would be with having such a strong heel for the babyfaces to face off and in this company. So now that we have a general timeline of All Japan Women's Wrestling in the 70s, let's take a moment to spotlight some of the idols in this crazy decade. So one of the first that I wanted to highlight, and her story is just like incredible with all these twists and turns, is Mak Fumiyake. And she has, in my opinion, one of the best stories out of All Japan Women's Wrestling from this decade, and honestly in general in the history of All Japan Women's Wrestling. She was the first idol of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling who won the WWA title at 16 years old. She only wrestled for a year in the company, and she made such a big impression with the fan base. And most importantly, she helped to lay out a roadmap to success that All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling wanted to replicate in the form of tag teams not too long after her run. Unfortunately, when I was doing research, really most of her work is not really available to see online. It's maybe like a few clips, but even with the lack of footage, Mak's presence is still felt within the tapestry of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, especially with those founding years. And don't feel bad for Mak because she went on to have success in the entertainment industry after her stint in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, mostly finding success on TV shows and appearing in a 1980s kaiju film entitled Nezero, as a superpower alien. And I really went down the rabbit hole once I found that out, and I just started looking at everything about it. And it was just like a cool, like, how cool does that look? I love that immediately after her run, at such a young age, she was able to easily transition into more opportunities in the entertainment world in Japan and really have a new life, essentially, as she was becoming an adult. In transition, well, as I've really observed with a lot of women that had to retire early, as that was a rule in All Japan Pro Wrestling, they were able to have these successful careers after that and really kind of live nine lives, you know, with all these different transitions that their life took successfully after having their runs. And I just love this look of this film, and it just really reeks in a good way of like that 70s look to a lot of the Japanese films that came out at the time. And I will say, I did not get time to do this before the show, but I am going to find this film because I am a sucker for a really cheesy, just funny B movies that many times doesn't really even have a full-on storyline, but is just good fun. So I will watch this for research sake, you know, to see how this was and to get a glimpse of Fumiyake's career after she left All Japan Wrestling. Now, we see that blueprint that Mak Fumiyake gave to All Japan Wrestling with her success. So then we go into a tag team that really is the face of what All Japan was for wrestling represented at this time. And that's certainly Beauty Pair. Beauty Pair, if if you ever even just attempt to look up All Japan Women's Wrestling, you're usually going to find this phenomenal tag team pop up in your search. The tag team that was made up of Jackie Sato and Maki Uido. And they were so amazing because I don't think that even with All Japan trying to decide what they want to do with them, I don't think anyone could predict this type of success that a tag team could have like they did. Not only were Beauty PR a successful tag team, but they became pop stars during their time in Japan. And at first glance, when you're thinking about wrestling prior to Beauty PR's time, you wouldn't naturally think that pop music and women's wrestling and having your stars of the company doing those things would actually go together. But in some weird way, it definitely did pair well. And Beauty PR was able to win tag team gold while still making music videos and having singles and variety show-like performances that had the ladies dripped in 70s ABBA-inspired attire and all the feathered hair that you could handle. And their height, Beauty PR had the tag team titles and an actual record deal with RCA Records, which is one of the biggest music studios in the world. So to think about that, that's insane popularity that they were able to have during this time. And they had a show called Beauty PR Show, which was essentially a variety show, which was very popular at the time. You showed the two performers or sometimes a family that could do everything. They could sing, they could dance, they could have some sketches on the show. Beauty PR did all of that. So this was just, to me, all in the stars. You know, how everything aligned for this tag team. They had magazines, t-shirts, trading cards, you name it. And there was even a movie done about them and a manga anime inspired show called Dirty Pair. So anything that you can think of that their face could be on, it was on, and they were marketed out the wazoo. I mean, they just had it. And these young women absolutely could not get enough of Beauty PR. And I like that, just like I was saying, we started off in this decade with Beauty PR. Sorry, we started off this decade with the foundation of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. Everyone would have moments in the crowd where they would kind of make noise. But when Beauty PR came onto the scene, that was a completely different level of success and ovation from the crowd. These young girls would go crazy whenever Beauty PR would come out, and they could not get enough. And it's so crazy with all the success that Beauty PR had that was actually only 3 years of work that they did together. And because of the nature of All Japan Women's Wrestling, they possibly could have gone further. But the women started to go more into singles competition, which was successful, but I don't know if it was the same level of success as it was from when they were a tag team. And because of the rule about retiring when you're 26, we saw Maki Uida had to retire in 1979. So when you're thinking about the success that they received in the middle of the 70s, and then Maki having to retire a few years after that when she was still in her prime, that's just insane. And it really broke my heart to see the fans with these young girls and tearful to see one of their idols have to retire when she was just getting started. And you can see also that really bothered Maki too. She probably felt like she had so much more to give to the company, to the fans. But luckily, with all of the things that they did do in the business, they were inducted into the All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1998. It was such a beautiful ceremony, and you could truly see that the Beauty PR were very honored and happy to see that their work received that type of recognition. So with the success of Beauty Pair, you can't have a great baby face team without having a heel team. And that's exactly what All Japan Women's Wrestling was thinking about when they decided to bring on the Black Pair. That's right. You have another tag team that could not stand the success of Beauty Pair. And this team was made up of Yumi Ikushita and Shinobu Aso. And they really played well off of their feud with Beauty Pair. And when I was looking at comments and watching some of these matches, I completely agreed and immediately thought in my head that what you're seeing, these very young girls that don't have much experience initially in this beginning of the decade, the thing that I like that All Japan Pro Wrestling made sure that they did capitalize on was showing how dirty the heels will get and really turning up the entertainment and psychological factor and really building a story to possibly take from the flaw that a lot of these women were still learning how to wrestle. And those things that they highlighted in these matches really helped to make you feel like this was just such an entertaining feud that had you on the edge of your seat as a fan. And I really liked how they did it. They hid those flaws to make sure that they were still showing off these women well. So I thought that that was probably one of the most well-done feuds from the 70s within this crazy electric 1970s tag team division that they had. And we have another well-known tag team called Queen Angels. I love that name. I love all the names, by the way, that they had. And they were a very successful tag team that were able to hold gold as well. And of course, they had their things with Beauty Pair as well, as Beauty Pair just had a target on the head, okay? You can't be that successful without everybody trying to come for you. And Queen Angels was no different. As you can see in this picture, everyone at that point was trying to take a stab at seeing if they could also find some type of success with this crossover with the pop music world and wrestling. So it started to become the norm in the company, which I actually thought was cool. And Queen Angels was able to find some great success as well, as they had some great victories during their time in the company. Now we're going to move on to someone that to me was one of the most dominant women's champions in the promotion during the 70s, and I think really helped to set a standard for what a lot of women would be doing later on and build off that. And that was Jumbo Miyamoto. She was this larger-than-life wrestler and one of the founding members of the roster. She would usually come into a match quiet, was a bit reserved. And then as soon as the bell rang, she was wreaking havoc on her opponents. And she did not give them a chance to breathe. She was always on them. And you see this become, to be honest, one of the norms whenever you would see women's wrestling in Japan, just that swift, crazy, strong, aggressive style that we all know and love from a lot of Joshi wrestling. Jumbo was really showing that during her time. And her short stature didn't take away from her clubbing blows that would leave her opponents trying to feel that they're still alive. And Jumbo had the most singles title reigns of any woman in the company in the 70s. So she's definitely someone that deserves to be highlighted in this capsule of All Japan Women's Wrestling in the 70s. I just loved her style. I loved how, just like I said, it would be like a switch that would come off from the time she entered the ring, when she was just very quiet and demure, and then she would just snap into this woman that would be yelling and raving and just tearing her opponent apart. And I absolutely loved it. So she was someone that I loved doing a bit of research on for this episode. So we move on to another one that I actually discovered during this search, and that is Lucy Koyama. And I just absolutely love her look. She was someone that had, excuse me, a four-year run And she really made an impact during that time as well. She was well known for having a high flying style, which was not the norm necessarily at that time. And she was known to take big bumps and pull off the tiger driver. So someone that I feel that in her time really helped to elevate what the women could do in the ring. She had a super athletic body and build that I think was leaning more towards that late 70s, early 80s look that a lot of women started to have. And especially in Japan, really starting to incorporate a lot of high-flying, technical-based wrestling that really made them stand out. So Lucien was one of those first women to really display that unique style that I feel Joshi wrestling was really helping to spearhead in the 70s, 80s, and certainly the 90s. So she's definitely one that had to make the list because she's very impressive. We go on to someone that a lot of people know, but they may not know, especially in this generation, what this woman did in All Japan Women's Wrestling, and that is Monster River. And it really irks me when people don't know her history and they only know her as Bertha Faye in WWE, because in 1979, Monster Ripper came into All Japan Wrestling as a newbie, but quickly established herself as a top foreign heel that would have a phenomenal run in the company in the following decades to come. Her look was so badass and it really drew you in. Her style really evolved, and there were so many pictures that I wanted to show of Monster Ripper going forward, but all of those are from the other decades that she's in. You would definitely tell by those looks, but I'm really looking forward in this series of going into her evolution, whether it was the way that she wrestled or her overall appearance that I absolutely dug. She was such a badass and so far removed from the Bertha Faye gimmick that she was given in WWE. When Monster Ripper came into All Japan Wrestling, she was only in the business for 8 months, but she looked impressive standing toe-to-toe with the other women on the roster. And I would really implore you, if you've never seen her work outside of WWE, not that, and I must say this, when Bertha Faye's time came in the ring, when she was able to show off what she could do, she was always very impressive with the in-ring work, and she definitely made the best of that character that she was given. But there's no way, if you look at her work in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, that you don't lean towards really seeing a person that has characters that are completely night and day from each other. So if you want to see more of that badass 80s, almost like biker kick type of role that she had, I would definitely implore you to look up Monster Ripper and just go down the rabbit hole and see everything that she did in All Japan Women's Wrestling. And the last woman that I want to showcase in this spotlight for the women in All Japan Women's Wrestling in the 70s is Mariko Akagi. And I have to say, when I was doing my research and I would see the way that Mariko would come to the ring, the way that she looked and the way she presented herself, it was so classy. I loved it. She just, to me, embodied a certain look from the 70s that I actually love. I'm always a sucker for someone that knows how to wear and really pull off an awesome robe and attire and really just have, in my opinion, because it goes along with it, something that makes you feel like you have thought about how you want to come to the ring and also how that goes into your character. And Mariko was certainly one of them as I was doing this research. She had just such elegance and poise as she would come to the ring, and a style and grace that I don't think was replicated by any other woman in the company at the time. But then when Mariko would take off that robe and you would see just sheer muscle almost obviously was like more of a swimmer's body and that athletic prowess, you can definitely see that to me, she was more of what I feel it should have continued to represent in the 70s and all of Japan was wrestling, which is some of their stronger competitors that they had in the company. And Mariko was certainly that. She had a very tough, ferocious style and was not afraid to really get into it with these women in the ring. Despite the elegance and the grace, she could get down in the ring. And I really like, once again, just like what I was talking about with Jumbo Miyamoto, Mariko had no problem turning off that switch and really getting into it in these matches. And just very strong technical and mat-based work that really stood out. And I'm probably going to find some more matches for hers because I was thoroughly entertained by her ring entrance, her very elegant way of coming off to the fans, and then that ferocious style that she had. And I loved her build. She was just chiseled out. I just loved her look. I can't speak enough for highly of her. She was just awesome to me. And I actually really enjoyed seeing her matches. And I was happy to find that there was a bit of footage because, guys, sometimes in this research for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling in the 70s, it was not always easy finding pictures, clips, actual matches, somewhat of a timeline, you know, with how certain things went, who had a title reign when. It was not always easy. So whenever I was able to find what I needed, it was always a good day. So just like I was saying, when she takes off the robe, you see this build, this very athletic build, and I just absolutely loved Mariko's style. She was awesome. So, yes, that's my spotlight on these awesome women that were part of All Japan's Women's Wrestling and their infant stages and how they really took those first 10 years and made sure that they started to focus on what can help set them apart. Because at that time, obviously, the male wrestling demographic was the only that really existed and that was taken seriously at the time. And just, I would say, 4 to 5 years, All Japan Women's Wrestling was able to change that in the 70s. And not only that, they were able to create some amazingly well-known wrestlers and pop stars at the same time, which is insane. And to have a super successful TV deal that went on for decades. And I don't think that that's something that anybody should sleep on, especially because of the range of people that they could reach with such a well-known TV deal or company as Fuji TV. I love how the marketing was on point. They knew how to reach that demographic they want. And I like that at that time, and I would say it was the same definitely in the 80s and the 90s, that All Japan Pro Wrestling knew what their demographic was. And they stuck with that and they kept a certain vision for where they wanted the company to go, how they wanted the women to be perceived. The only thing, even though I kind of get it, but it was still heartbreaking to see this with a lot of women, is how they would be on this all-time high and really reach success. But because they aged out of the promotion, they would have to bow out while they were still in their prime. So that was a bit sad to see as I was doing the research. And I already knew about that rule, but when you were seeing how young they were, and then just like I was bringing up with the beauty pair, how you may have only had 3 years to really ride that amazing ride that I don't know if you can get off that high of having fans that are clamoring for you like that. And you're being told that you just have to let all that go. And now that run is done. That's really insane. So I can't imagine that feeling. Now, once we get into the 80s, we'll start to talk about how a lot of women that were extremely successful in All Japan fought against that 26-year-old rule of retiring and how that actually worked for the business in some ways. And we'll really get into the meat of that because I like that pushback from it and how a lot of women started to have more of a say on when they felt that it was time to retire. But this was, in my opinion, very exciting to research because it really gives you a tone of where Japan was post-World War II, what their vision was for women's wrestling, and how they were successful, even with the ups and downs of the 50s, trying to figure out what they were going to do, their interactions with women like Mildred Berg, and how that helped to solidify what they wanted to do, and how they were off to the races once we got into 1970 and really pushed forward to take women's wrestling to the stratosphere in Japan and really accomplish things that, just like I said, in some ways haven't really been accomplished in other promotions to this day. So we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to go into my final thoughts for this episode.
Hey, yo, you. Yeah, you that's watching this. You sitting on the couch staring at the screen not knowing what you want to do, like this is an online college. Are you tired of wearing shirts that make you look like an extra stuck in catering? Do you want to step your wrestling swag game up to the next level? Then Women's Wrestling Talk has got you covered. Like, literally. Are you for life in pink or black and white? Or maybe you're the EST and people need to respect you accordingly. Want to put some pride in your stride and show off the muscle in your hustle? Then make sure you check out the WWT store. Not now, but right now. All right? What you waiting for? Head to www.talkpodstore.com and don't make me fight you. Shit.
All right, guys. So you know what you got to do. You got to get that Women's Wrestling Talk merch as soon as possible, because I will say the Boss Lady TK has made sure that we have some of the best looking gear for any podcast out there right now. So let's get into this final thought. With all the research that I've done on this subject, specifically of the 70s wrestling and All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, I love that All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling stuck their flag into the ground and made it clear that they were very serious about having women's wrestling really be showcased to the masses in a way that it hadn't been. Honestly, I would say in any part of the world, even with the success of a lot of champions for NWA, I think that the way that women's wrestling catapulted to heights that are just absolutely insane, All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling certainly did that in such a short span of time, which is really awe-inspiring, honestly. All these women were super talented, and even when they came in and possibly needed to, you know, sit under the learning tree and learn more, they utilized the strengths that they did have, and they really put on a great show. However, because of the 26-year rule, every top star had to retire while they were still in their prime. And it was sad to see them bow out. And then not only bow out, but once you started getting to the end of this decade, a lot of women started to apply for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. So they had to bow out and then in many cases train their successor when they still felt like they had a lot to give. So that could not have been easy. This is where, and I'm so excited for the next episode of Deep Dive, because we start getting into the roaring 80s for All Japan Pro Wrestling, Women's Pro Wrestling. And this was such an explosive decade for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. As I stated before, with this first decade, All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, we're putting the pieces together. But once you had these women and trainers that knew exactly what formula they wanted to use to build up stars and what type of style they wanted, they were absolutely unstoppable and put on matches that are just absolute classics to this day. So getting into this decade where the company has a solid footing, they still have their Fuji TV deal, and they have the blueprint on how to make a star, and they did that in spades in the 80s. But not only that, you start having these female wrestlers that are just learning some techniques that still blows my mind to this day. So I am very excited to get into the 80s. On the next episode, you had a decade that had the dirtiest of heels and the sweetest of baby faces that caused sheer hysteria for whenever they would come to the ring. If we thought it was crazy in the 70s with Beauty Pair, it got absolutely nuts for tag teams like Crush Gals, who were, in my opinion, the most successful tag team, male or female, that have ever come out of Japan, or to be honest, out of the world. But we will discuss all those things on the next episode. Thank you so much for watching. I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope that you're looking forward to the rest of this series. We really dive into Joshi wrestling and all of the many great, awesome, sucky things that came out of it all together, and just enjoy this thing called wrestling. Thank you so much for watching, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Women's Wrestling Talk, the number one women's wrestling show on the planet.